This is a podcast from the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge.
I'm standing here in the Fitzwilliam Museum at the entrance of Endless Forms, Darwin, Natural Science and the Visual Arts. My name's Paul Nurse. I'm a biologist, but I'm not an expert in Darwin or evolution. I'm a cell and molecular biologist, and I'm at present president of Rockefeller University in New York. What's interesting is that for us biologists, evolution is really central. As Theodosius Dobzhansky said, who was also at Rockefeller University, nothing really makes sense in biology except in terms of evolution. So although I'm no expert in Darwin, I'm certainly very interested in it. Well, I'm moving forward to the right. It's the Sheba Gallery, and here we have a number of artifacts which were in Cambridge when Charles Darwin was a student, both in the Fitzwilliam and also in the library. Just in front of me here is a large book from Jan Swammerdam. He was a biologist, a Dutch biologist in the 17th century. We have a wonderful portrait of a head of a male bee. And we can also see some interesting things actually collected by Darwin himself. Isn't that interesting? So we have a beetle. It's a water beetle. It looks like that to me. He was a great collector of beetles. I remember a story once about him where he found one beetle under a rock and then had it in one hand, and then he found another and he had no idea where to put it. So he popped it in his mouth so he could keep that beetle for later. And we can also see his microscope here as well. So real connections with Darwin, the man himself. Oh, here's a great picture. This is drawn by Darwin himself. He was on the Beagle, the boat which he spent 4 or 5 years on sailing around the world, particularly South America. And he was particularly interested in geology at the time. And he's drawn and coloured a cross-section of the Andes in Chile. And it's firstly really quite accurate and a sort of good geologist drawing. And really fascinating to see the handiwork of Charles himself. And it's all got scribbles all over it, some of which I can hardly read, which give presumably some indication of what he thought was going on with the geology. I've never seen anything really quite like this. It's very, very, very interesting. And Darwin, of course, was a pigeon fancier. And here I've just discovered a nice picture of a rather exotic pigeon, a pewter with a very, very large chest, and he was very, very interested in the breeding of pigeons. In fact, joined pigeon fancying clubs to learn all about it. And he tried to get a theory of genetics from that. He wasn't quite successful at that, but he was very, very interested in how pigeons were bred to get different forms. On the wall here is a plate from Wedgwood, and Darwin was descended from the Wedgwoods, and also from Erasmus Darwin, who was his grandfather. Now, Erasmus was a very interesting character, late 18th century character, who was very interested in evolution and wrote several books about it. He wrote them in blank verse and was actually better known as a poet. And Erasmus was a great supporter of evolution. Charles Darwin was not the originator of the idea of evolution, although he did the mechanism by natural selection, although hinted at by others, he really properly argued. But Erasmus Darwin thought that life had evolved. He was a very interesting character. He was a physician in Lichfield, and so he made most of his money from his rich patients. But he had these revolutionary ideas about evolution, and he painted on his coach, in Latin, a motto, everything from shells, because he thought all life was descended from simple forms, such as a formless mollusk, a shell. And the dean of Lichfield Cathedral really didn't like this motto and began to talk about Erasmus and saying that he shouldn't be seen by respectable people. And so he began to lose his clientele. So he had to paint out his motto. So there's always been this rather uneasy relationship over hundreds of years, really, between some scientists and some in the church. He was perhaps a little outrageous for the Darwins later in the 19th century, but there is no doubt that Charles was completely familiar with him and his ideas, and I suspect that may have launched him in some of his thoughts about evolution later in life. Well, I move out now from the Sheba, and that's a sort of general entree into the main exhibition. And there's this fantastic portrait of Charles Darwin in front of me here. This is the one from the National Portrait Gallery. It's later in his life, he looks the real sage. What you see is not only the intellectual, but also the observational naturalist. He's got a sort of battered hat there in his left hand. And you get a sense that he's both thinking about the problems and also observing them. It's his eyes that seem to be really striking. They're very, very intense, as if he concentrates on things. As a scientist myself, it's observing, I know, it's so important to observe nature and really follow where nature takes you. Some people have an idea that we should actually impress our mind upon nature. Really, it should be the other way around. Observing nature tells us where we should put our mind to work. And I think we see that in Charles's intense look there. On the other side of Charles is, his great work, published in 1859, the first edition on the origin of species by means of natural selection. This revolutionised the world. It's a great book. I have a second edition myself, which was published 3 months later. And it really did revolutionise the world. And I'm always somewhat overcome when I see the copy of this book here, written in Downhouse in Kent, and summarising in about 400 pages his really, really important ideas. When you move from his image, you come into the first part of the main exhibition, which emphasises Charles's interest in geology, because his main interests initially were in geology, and this subject was undergoing a real transformation at this time. Up until this period, not much was thought to have changed in the Earth's history. It was thought to be rather constant. But ideas were developing that there were and had been major changes, but over a very significant period of time. And we have here a series of pictures illustrating the history of the Earth, a great Turner that we have here, and a very nice painting of Pegwell Bay, Kent, where we have several women and a child looking around on a beach, a cliff behind, picking up pebbles and stones, maybe fossils, an interest in natural history overspilling into geology. And then there seems to be a comet, actually, in the top of the painting there. So this is really, for me at least, talking about science and observing the world in mid-Victorian England. And I noticed the comet because, although I'm a biologist, I have an amateur interest in astronomy. I wouldn't call it scientific as much as just like looking at the planets and the stars and galaxies. And of course, comets are particularly exciting. I've only seen maybe half a dozen comets in my lifetime, and they're always dramatic. Even today, when we understand what they are, but hundreds of years ago, of course, they were portents for great changes and perhaps somewhat frightening. And moving from the fossils in the same room, we see lots of illustrations of nature. And then on the other side of the room, a dying stag, two stags who have been fighting, and now there's a fox presumably thinking, well, there's going to be a good meal here. So nature in the raw. And Darwin always was thinking about the impact of his natural history observations on human beings and whether we could understand human beings better. And there's a rather moving picture of a striking worker and his family, painted just after Darwin died in 1891. And we see a rather heroic picture of a worker and his family, a young baby holding a spoon, obviously hungry, mother very distressed, but a very resolute man. But this was an example of what came to be called social Darwinism, that is, competition between individuals, and those that didn't succeed suffered. Not sure Darwin really pushed that hard himself. Others like Herbert Spencer certainly did. But often Darwinism is caricatured in this sort of way. Well, we move from that first quite striking gallery, I have to say, into a new gallery. And this is exploring, it seems to me, particularly the relationship between human beings and animals. So in this room, the first painting that attracts my attention is this one called Alexander and Diogenes, also by Landseer, and a collection of dogs. And of course, dogs quite interesting because they've been artificially bred to be all sorts of sizes and all sorts of shapes, all sorts of colours. So we see genetics at work here, and we see dogs being bred for different purposes. Again, very central to Darwin's ideas of being adapted to purpose, adapted to function. Now, the descent of man. This was, of course, Charles's second famous book after The Origin of Species. And in The Origin of Species, although he hinted that that humans were, of course, related and descended from animals, ape-like creatures, he was much less explicit than in The Descent of Man. So that was his very important book. And there's a painting here called Evolution by George Frederick Watts. And what we see here is a picture of children round a sort of Earth Mother type figure, maybe despairing about how her babies will be subject to selection, not all of them will survive. It maybe reflected the mortality of children in the 19th century, which made so much sense, of course, in terms of evolution by natural selection. Evolution was probably a bit frightening, really, for in the 19th century, as it is for many in the 20th and now the 21st century. And there's some rather scary images from Odilon Redon. And they sort of are a little monstrous. We have a sort of centaur-like creature. We have a one-eyed monster, several of those. We have winged horses. This is all sort of pretty archetypal, mythological figures. But you get a sense of unease looking at this. Of course, he's often an artist that makes you feel uneasy. But you get a sense that there was a possibility for generating monsters, is how I think I would put it, and that human beings are maybe just on the edge of being being monstrous. And that's reinforced by another picture, an engraving, I think, really quite interesting, where human beings are pursuing centaurs, that sort of human-horse sort of hybrid. And I've never actually seen a sort of mixture quite like that before. But once again, it's the image here seems to be that there's nothing quite constant, that animals and humans can somehow mix, and that the previously well-accepted views that animals and humans were completely separate is perhaps been lost after Darwin. We see these sort of mixtures, these hybrids, these chimeras, which were the stuff of mythology, but which your imagination could now be let loose and you could imagine really could exist. Well, you come into here and what you see immediately are some illustrations and examples of some of the more exotic forms of nature. And just immediately on the left, we see two examples of that. A wonderful orchid. And Darwin was interested in orchids and wrote one of his more popular books, in fact, on orchids. And also some hummingbirds. We see here the real beauty of nature. And they are examples, particularly the hummingbird colouring, of a really important idea that Charles had, sexual selection. In birds, for example, where that's seen in an extreme form, it's often that the male develops fantastical feathers and coloured shows to try and impress a female to mate with him. And there's a really wonderful video in the corner of the gallery here, which is a video of a male Argus pheasant. And the male himself has got extraordinary feathers, he's got a great ruff behind his head, a tail split in two, a wonderful beast, and he's displaying to a female Argus, running around her and trying to attract her attention. And as is so often the case in these sorts of displays, the female just looks profoundly bored. She barely looks interested in this strutting about, as males so often do, of course, around the female. Whether she's being hypnotized or is just simply uninterested, it's difficult to say. And these feathers not only were used to bind the birds themselves, but of course human beings used them to beautify themselves. And a comment that was often made in Victorian times, and we can still note today, is that in humans it's the female of the species that is usually dressing up, at least in theory, to attract the male. And there's a nice juxtapositioning in this exhibition of some stuffed birds here, very, very exotic, very beautiful feathers. And then a painting by James Tissot with women dressed up in wonderful hats, also containing the birds' feathers, probably some of them similar to the feathers that we see around us. So this idea of sexual selection, that is, choosing your mate, I'm sure was another challenge for the 19th century society, that women were playing a role there to attract a male, attract a mate. And in this gallery we have a variety of paintings. There's one here by Rossetti of a woman doing her toilet to make sure she's attractive for the rest of the day. And there's a sense of beauty here which sexual selection can perhaps partly explain. And these sort of fascinating links between animals, particularly birds, and human beings are really made here. So we leave the feathers and we move into the final room, which is exploring Darwin and Impressionism, which is not something I'd really thought of myself before. But it is true that the Impressionists, some of them at least, were very interested in the natural world. And there's several paintings here by Monet which are focusing on rock formations and sort of reflect the interest in geology that we were talking about with Charles earlier on in the exhibition. So Monet did a number of paintings of rocks and of cliffs, and we see several examples here, and probably influenced by the increasing interest in geology. And an extraordinary picture of a book. I've never seen this anything like this before. It's a picture of something that looks a bit like a dinosaur standing in a Parisian street. It's an illustration in a book. And it's on its hind legs, and it's up on about the sixth floor, giving a real sense of the scale of some of these extinct that had been discovered by the fossil hunters of the 19th century. Cézanne had a real interest in rocks, probably played a role in his transition towards more abstract painting, and he focused on the abstract shapes of nature, including rocks, and he did many paintings. There's one here from the grounds of the Chateau Noir, and we see the rocks there in the background, again reflecting the interest in the natural world. And in the middle of the room is the very famous Degas dancer. She's sort of standing here really completely in her physicality, I would say. It sort of emphasises her as a real physical person. I don't know if Degas was influenced by the change in thinking brought about by Charles Darwin, but certainly I look upon this very well-known statue in a slightly different way, looking at this image here. It's as if she's seen as part of the whole living world, the animal kingdom, rather than something apart. And perhaps that's what Charles Darwin really did contribute to understanding of society, that we shouldn't view ourselves separate from the rest of life. And indeed, if we are the so-called pinnacle of evolution, but we are related to all other life forms, maybe that's the best reason we could think of for playing the role as custodian of all life on the planet, because all other living things are our cousins, and don't we have a responsibility for them? And perhaps that's one of the great ideas that Darwin had that we should still be paying attention to today. So I'm standing here next to the Degas statue at the end of the exhibition, and as a scientist it makes me think of what Charles contributed to our understanding of the world. And the really important ideas, the ideas that all living things are related, that human beings should not be kept or thought of as separate from other life forms, and also his brilliant idea of evolution by natural selection, which is so important even today in thinking about biology. As a scientist myself, I just feel totally humbled. Here I'm standing in an exhibition that has focused on one of the great scientists, great intellectuals of all time. And I can only feel humbled seeing all these artifacts about him and how he influenced the world.